content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. So in this episode, we'll wrap up the December issue of Our State Magazine, which features articles inspired by familiar Christmas carols. To round out the episode, we'll probably get to a couple of articles from the regular columns, which we don't normally cover in a four-week month, since there are 5 weeks in December. The first one up is actually the cover story. It's called The Little Drummer Boy. For more than 200 years, villagers in Rodanthe have celebrated Christmas on their own terms. And we have a picture of a vintage drum here. It says, the story of Rodanthe's drum of an old Christmas begins with the 12-year-old Scottish boy who brought the instrument to Hatteras Island and is intertwined with two centuries of Outer Banks tradition. On the corner of the stage in the old Rodanthe schoolhouse sits a drum propped on a metal folding chair. The rope tensions stand in contrast to its cracked and peeling hoops and brittle leather ears. The patinated shell, scarred by time, and its taut head, worn, torn, patched, and repaired, is a lasting artifact of a steadfast Hatteras Island tradition, unique to its northernmost village wedged between the Atlantic Ocean and Pamlico Sound. Believed to be the same one used 200 years ago to kick off Old Christmas, the drum is still here to bear witness with a winding origin story that some say begins in 1746 with the right to the British throne. Rodanthe's drum of Old Christmas, also known as the drum of Bonnie Prince Charlie, who was used by the Jacobite army during the Battle of Culloden, explains Ryan Gentry, one of the Midget family historians. As the story goes, during the battle, a non-fatal arrow struck the 12-year-old Scottish drummer, Donald MacDonald, in the left shoulder. After his recovery, he set sail to the New World, drum in tow. During the voyage, MacDonald fell overboard during a storm and swam to shore using the drum as a life preserver. He arrived at the place where he'd spend the rest of his life, Rodanthe. The drum is folklore-made material, a symbol of persistence and resistance. It bridges past and present. According to legend, decades had passed when the news reached Hatteras Island that England had, in 1752, adopted the Gregorian calendar that changed Christmas from January 6 or 7 to December 25th. Committed to their ways, the villagers of Rodanthe refused to go along with the change and continued celebrating Jesus' birth when and how they always had. That celebration began with a procession of revelrous villagers led by the beloved drum and a crew of musicians to a community gathering. Though the drum is now too old to be played, its spirit carries forth a tradition older than the village itself. Old Christmas in Rodanthe, a ritual of culture specific to place and distinctive in its curious customs, remains a wild, wonderful, and unique event that marches to its own beat. And on this page, we have a picture of the drum. It says, although the drum of Old Christmas can no longer be played, it remains a centerpiece of the holiday for Ryan Gentry and his son, who are pictured there, much as it was for Miss Elvira Payne in 1961. And it looks like in 1961, they were still able to play the drum. And Miss Elvira is playing the drum in that older picture. The man in red velvet squares his shoulder, placing one black foot before the other, and raises the muzzle skyward. He swings the butt of the gun to his shoulder, the stock landing under his snowy white beard, and shifts it until the gun finds the soft groove below his collarbone. Flipping off the safety, he squints one eye to peer through his wire-rimmed spectacles down the barrel. As his finger grazes the trigger, the bullet races one way and his shoulder the other, the gold trim of his jacket gleaming in the afternoon light. The crack of the gunshot ricochets off the wall of paper targets, and a cloud of gunpowder, white as his beard, drifts from the barrel. Santa examines the target and confirms what he already knows. He hit the bullseye. These days, 300 rounds of discharged ammunition at the annual oyster shoot have replaced the processional drumbeats that once declared the start of Old Christmas. Connie Midget Page, Ryan's mother, peeks out the back door of the old schoolhouse that now serves as a community building for the island's tri-villages, Rodanthe, Waves, and Salvo. The smell of stewed chicken wafts into the yard from the open door, mingling with the scent of gunpowder. The oyster shoots, next round of contestants, a mirage of marsh grass, camouflage, approaches the firing line, aiming to win a half bushel of oysters. Connie spots Brent Midget, today Santa, and the two embrace. "Happy Old Christmas," she exclaims warmly. The two reminisce about old Christmases past, both swelling with pride to have roots in a place for as long as anyone can remember. Everyone was kin to everybody. There were no tourists, and there was no bridge. "This was our event for our community," Connie says. She gives Santa another hug and hurries back to the kitchen, where steam pours out of the 4 20-quart pots holding 80 pounds of stewing chicken. "I took over cooking the chicken and pastry when my mother stopped, who took over when her mother stopped. I'll be 3/4 a century old this year, so it's about time for me to start thinking about when I'm going to stop," Connie says, winking at her daughter, Lovey Heilig, and grandson Noah Gentry across the counter. Chicken and pastry might seem odd for a village whose foodways are rooted in the sea, but it's a tradition passed down through the generations. "Back then, everyone had chickens," Connie explains. "The young men would go raid everyone's chicken coops for the chicken and pastry, but everyone knew they were coming." With the chicken stewed, Connie joins Noah in rolling out 25 pounds of dough for the pastry, just as her mother and grandmother did decades before. One day, he may bear the family torch, but for now they work as a team. Soon, an orderly line of tri-villagers and visitors will wind around the kitchen, waiting for a helping. Through time, the merriment around Rodanthe's old Christmas grew, and the celebration earned a rowdy reputation. Brawls were commonplace, and the evening became the village's customary time to settle old scores. Busted lips and black eyes were the means by which grudges were ironed out and slates were cleaned for the new year. It was a dry island back then, so the men would keep liquor in their cars. "There'd always be a fight between cousins or brothers, but they'd get up and laugh it off," Connie says, grinning. While today's celebration clings to many traditions, civility has prevailed, and there have been no fights in recent years, at least not in public. Among the traditions that survived this rowdy era is one of the more eccentric fixtures, the mythical wild bull whose spirit roams the yaupon and wax myrtle of the island's maritime forest. According to widely varying folklore, a bull named Old Buck swam to shore on Hatteras Island in the 1700s or 1800s as a shipwreck's sole survivor. The cantankerous rabble-rouser made himself at home among the island's many free-ranging cattle, becoming a menace to farmers and fathering a calf with every cow from Oregon Inlet to Hatteras Inlet. But once a year, on the night of Old Christmas, Old Buck would take leave of his antagonism and join in the holiday merriment, socializing with all the villagers, allowing good children to ride on his back, and bucking off those who had been naughty. A hunter's bullet would fate Old Buck, but his spirit lived on. To this day, he still appears every Old Christmas. In years past, summoned as the night's music was about to begin, a primitive incarnation emerged. Two young men beneath a blanket, four legs showing underneath, horns marking where the head should be. All of a sudden, Old Buck would come in through the front doors and start knocking down the chairs. Everyone would try to get a pat for good luck, Connie remembers. Old Buck's arrival was a sign to move the chairs out of the way because it was time for music and dancing. Old Buck is welcomed inside by jolly applause, and after having his rump patted dozens of times, the blanketed creature chaotically exits as quickly as he appears. With the dance floor now cleared, the night's band makes its way to the front, where the old drum sits. Born out of defiance of the Gregorian calendar, today's old Christmas celebration, in a way, remains an act of resistance to the changes still occurring all around Rodanthe. Many people here can trace their families back to the 10 households in the Tri-Villages area in the 1880s. Today, that handful of homes has ballooned to more than 500 households, many of which are the second or third homes of folks from inland or out of state. Swift development, significant environmental changes, and evolving demographics have drastically altered the social and cultural fabric that has defined Rodanthe since colonial times. It's difficult to look around, past the large homes and tourist-based economy, and find the Rodanthe of Connie's youth, but not on Old Christmas. Every year near January 6th, kinship and centuries-old traditions, no matter how unusual, bind generations of villagers and welcome newcomers. This shared singular heritage is a merry rhythm of resilience and community that no calendar, no amount of development, and no passage of time can dampen. It is the drumbeat that carries them forward. All right, the next article is Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Before the beard and the belly laugh, becoming the man in red requires a little magic and plenty of training in Charlotte, where Santas go to learn their ho, ho, ho. And we have a picture of Santas lined up, ready to be trained, I guess, in Santa. On the first day of advanced Santa studies, Titus Hopper, also known as Hop the Black Santa, provides a master class in Christmas cheer. There's no single agreed-upon term in the English language for a gathering of Santas, but perhaps there should be. A sleigh of Santas? A jingle of Kringles? A chimney full of St. Nicks? We need a term for it because it happens more often than you might think. And when it does, and when you find yourself in the midst of it, on a blistering hot Saturday in the middle of August, say, at a hotel in Charlotte, the wonder of Christmas is multiplied in ways impossible to have foreseen. Santa checking in at the front desk, for instance, or holding the elevator door for you, or one Santa waiting for another Santa, or perhaps Mrs. Claus in the lobby. You've stepped into a familiar reality turned wildly askew. But it's not a dream. It's the first day of advanced Santa studies class. Doug Eberhardt, who lives in Charlotte and created and runs this two-day seminar, who is a Santa himself and who in almost every way is smack dab in the middle of the Santa universe, puts on two big events a year. The first is an introductory class, the practical Santa, primarily for Santas just learning the craft, and the second is this one, the advanced class. Santas from various walks of life are here. A lawyer from Raleigh, a shopkeeper from Weldon, a claims adjuster from Lexington. Many are retired, but their goals are the same, to become the best possible Santa they can be, to be worthy inheritors of a myth. On offer this weekend is a rare opportunity for Santas all over the state and beyond to watch other Santas at work, to study their routines, and not unlike a child at the mall getting their picture taken with the man in red, to ply the old pros with questions of their own, such as, well, what do you say when they ask you where your reindeer are? No two Santas have the exact same answer to this question, or to any question for that matter, but you need at least one. Eberhardt, who leaves his reindeer across town in a field, has been a Santa off and on for almost half a century, starting when he was just 14 years old. He was a big kid, the kind of big that would go on to play center in the Princeton University football team. His mother made him his first three suits, and he still has one of them in a shadow box at his shop. Were he ever to be inducted to the International Santa Claus Hall of Fame based in Santa Claus, Indiana, and one day he may well be, this suit, like Mr. Rogers' sweater in the Smithsonian, could be there on display. He's come a long way since being a 14-year-old Santa. At events such as this one and through his Pro Santa websites like ProSantaShop.com and RentaSanta.com, he is now a major supplier of Santa suits and any and all Santa-related accoutrement you could imagine, including golden belt buckles, designer beard and wigs, toy bags, boots, and assorted Kringle bling. But what Eberhardt provides through his work, his workshops, and his website is so much more than that. The men here, about 70 of them, mostly in jeans and T-shirts, looking like Santa on the weekend about to tackle some yard work, represent a self-selecting cross-section of Middle America. And while all Santas are alike in some obvious ways, there are some subtle but important differences between them as well. The laugh, the songs they sing, the calibrated sense of humor, the bag of tricks and props. The possibilities are endless, and that's why so many men with snowy white beards and unapologetically respectable girths are in this ballroom together to discover who they are. On the first day of Advanced Santa Studies class, we witnessed three exceptional Santas perform their routines. Three more, including Eberhardt, will perform tomorrow. The first is Rich Lang of Huntersville. Lang is an example of the traditional Santa. He has a pleasant, grandfatherly demeanor and a booming voice, and he nails the trademark, ho, ho, ho. He has a ton of props, including a rack of actual reindeer antlers he passes around. His reindeer, back at the North Pole, resting up for Christmas. The second Santa is Titus Hopper. Hopper, a Shelby native, is the only black Santa in attendance this weekend. Instead of ho, 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 he says bro, ho, ho. He can also dance and has a beautiful singing voice. Where are his reindeer, you ask? He'll show you on the Reindeer Cam app on his phone. The third Santa is the headliner, Joe Barney, and he's unlike any Santa I have ever seen. Barney's on the smaller side. No way could he have played football for Princeton. And he dresses in a snappy and colorful outfit. It's stunning, but more like what a wealthy elf would wear for a night out on the town than what Santa might. A floppy cap bedazzled with giant jewels, a skinny Christmassy scarf, lederhosen, a tool belt, and a flawless designer beard that looks more real than a real one. He's funny, full of one-liners and snappy repartee. He could have done the same routine at a comedy club in Brooklyn, a wildly divergent, playful, sarcastic, and life-of-the-party Santa. Santa as a loopy uncle. Barney is a Santa for Macy's in New York City, and he was the White House Santa from George H.W. Bush presidency through Bill Clinton's tenure. His reindeer don't fly until Christmas Eve, the only time he can get permission from the FAA. Barney also talks about the business of being Santa because, yes, Virginia, being Santa is also a business. It's a part-time job. Most of us have only had a glimpse of what a Santa's life is really like and what's required to be successful at this seasonal gig. We have a photograph taken with him at the mall, mementos of our childhood in awe. Mementos of our children in awe or horror on his lap. But there's so much more to it. There are corporate events, church and school visits, Santa's in demand. According to Eberhardt, there is actually a Santa shortage. But home visits make up most of a Santa's work during the holidays and most of their paychecks, too. The average income for mall Santas from November to Christmas Eve is, according to Eberhardt, from $4,000 to $8,000. Many get far less than that, while a much smaller number earn more. Before attending the advanced class, I'd never heard of home visits. Imagine being a child and having Santa come to your home just to hang out for a little while. That's what home visits are, and it's where the practiced art of being Santa really comes into play. Families get Santa's undivided attention, so their routine must be solid. Think hours of practice, memorizing names ahead of time, knowing what might get kids off the naughty and onto the nice list. Be a good listener. Clean your room. Be kind. Each home visit is different, so you need to be able to improvise. Props come in handy. Antlers, magic tricks, sing-alongs, the staff on which you've inscribed the names of some of your elves. But in the end, it's about being Santa. And the attendant pressure and the responsibility of playing that role is not negligible. Santa is, after all, one of the most famous fictional people on the planet. And for many kids, he takes up more space in their imagination than almost anywhere else. There's a quasi-religious element at work there as well. So, sure, you can buy the suit and boots and the belts and the staff. You can get a fancy beard. You can travel to other Santa schools in Michigan and Georgia and learn more tips and tricks. And yes, training and equipment are an investment that might take two seasons to earn back. But look at what you're getting in return. You've become a representative of one of the last scraps of magic left to us, an authentic facsimile, the one and only Santa in a sleigh full of them. I believe in you. And probably for our last article here, it's a regular column called Hidden History, uncovering forgotten artifacts and delving into dusty archives to explore the little-known stories of our state. This is entitled A Light in the Darkness. For nearly 90 years, Winston-Salem IFB Solutions has been a beacon of opportunity for individuals who are blind or have low vision. Sometimes all it takes to open your eyes is a blindfold. That's what four ophthalmology residents from Wake Forest University School of Medicine are learning as participants in sensitivity to blindness training offered by IFB Solutions, formerly in the Industries for the Blind in Winston-Salem. The doctors have been given a seemingly simple task: walk 250 yards from a conference room in IFB Solutions manufacturing facility to a nearby Subway sandwich shop. Leading the way is training supervisor Kim Schaffner, who has provided the young physicians with blindfolds and walking canes. Schaffner lost her right eye due to retinoblastoma when she was 2. She lost sight in her left eye 13 years ago. When there was no more color or shape, I was sad for a few days, she said, but I realized I can't change it, so I said to myself, well, let's learn to do things the way I love to do. I woke up the next day and kept stepping forward. Schaffner's can-do disposition shines through as she kicks off the participants' journey with advice in the form of a couplet: sweep your cane side to side, keeping safe with every stride. Well, maybe not exactly stride. The residents move forward in a cautious cluster, listening intently to Schaffner's voice as she alerts them to impending obstacles. The canes become their eyes, identifying walls, curbs, and, oops, sorry, the shins of fellow doctors. There's laughter, confusion, and more than a little uncertainty. After a sightless dining experience at Subway, the participants return to IFB Solutions without blindfolds. Passing through the vast production floor, they see hundreds of blind or low-vision workers not just navigating the world but also engaging in a variety of demanding jobs amid the hum of hundreds of sewing machines, stitching, cutting, assembling, sorting, and packaging. IFB Solutions started in 1936 in a small one-room workshop where 6 employees caned chairs and made brooms. Those were the traditional activities in the 30s and 40s that sighted caregivers thought blind people were capable of, says President and CEO Dan Kelly. We've made a pretty remarkable transformation since then. How remarkable? Consider this. Today, IFB Solutions is the country's largest employer of people who are blind or visually impaired. The employees at the manufacturing facilities, which also include locations in Asheville and Puerto Rico, craft mission-critical military uniforms and gear, office supplies, mattresses, and more. Just about everyone who works here has a story to tell, perhaps none more inspiring than Kelly's. Kelly lost his vision in his teens from a hereditary condition that has took his grandfather's and his father's and grandfather's sight, but never let his visual limitations curb his aspirations. A few years after college, he went to work for the National Industries for the Blind in Washington, D.C. area, where he earned his MBA. As a former member of the U.S. Paralympic swim team, he won multiple gold medals, and he's also completed marathons, triathlons, and long-distance open water swims. Kelly says his father and grandfather gave him that vision of independent success from a very early age. Never give up. Never stop learning. Keep pushing forward. He's quick to credit others for his success. My story is not my story. It's the story of people who uplifted and supported my career, my life, and my pursuits. In many ways, Kelly is paying for the example set by local businessman who gave him his first job and made sure he had the tools he needed to succeed. I want to ensure that we are able to sustain and grow jobs for people who are blind, Kelly says. We're not going to let blindness stop us. Originally an initiative of the Winston-Salem Lions Club, Industries for the Blind, or IFB, benefited from the 1938 passage of the Wagner-O'Day Act, which provided opportunities for people who are blind to manufacture and provide essential goods to federal agencies. The legislation sought to address the lack of employment opportunities for people with visual impairments, a situation made worse by the Great Depression. Updated in 1971 as the Javits-Wagner-O'Day Act, it is now known as the Ability One Program. A merger with Goodwill Industries in 1958 furthered IFB's viability as a dependable, high-quality manufacturer. In 1979, Industries for the Blind split amicably from Goodwill Industries and embarked on the construction of a $3.7 million plant, which opened in 1993 and still houses IFB today. With 75,000 square feet of manufacturing, warehouse, and administrative space, the facility was big enough to help IFB realize its larger ambitions. Over the next several decades, IFB won or extended a wide range of civilian and military contracts, including the management of military-based supply centers. These retail outlets are staffed by IFB employees and carry many office products or made or packaged by them. Most famously, the ubiquitous Skillcraft pen has been manufactured and packaged by the Ability One organizations like IBF Solutions since 1968. One product in particular symbolizes the deep tie between IFB employees and the military, the Wooby. A cherished piece of gear issued to soldiers, the Wooby's official purpose is to line a poncho, but the versatile garment has also been used as a sleeping bag, blanket, hammock, tent, and more. The bond between soldier and Wooby is so strong that many are loath to give it up at the end of their service. Today, a large percentage of the companies that serve the blind are also led by the blind. We know that what we're capable of, Kelly says. The confidence is born out of the 5 Ability One companies that are associated with the National Industries for the Blind in North Carolina. According to Kelly, another reason for IFB's success is visionary leadership that has always had an entrepreneurial mindset. The board has allowed us to be out-of-the-box risk takers. For example, lack of transportation has long been a significant barrier to employment for those who are blind, yet advancements in technology have opened up new opportunity. Work-from-home call center staffing. IFB Solutions now has more than 500 people in its recruitment pipeline ready to excel in these jobs. By identifying the strengths of every employee and embracing technology, IFB makes it possible for them to take on new roles. We're thrilled to have at least one person who is blind in every department, Kelly said. It's a powerful testament to how far we've come. A little side article entitled One Cup at a Time. Another Ability One company, Industries of the Blind in Greensboro, employs hundreds in the manufacture of a wide range of military gear while also offering distribution and logistics solutions to businesses large and small. But it's the company's 33 and Elm Coffee House that produces something even more valuable, goodwill and understanding. The staff of blind and sighted workers serves employees from Industries of the Blind as well as a loyal following of nearby residents and college students. Industries of the Blind was founded in 1933, says coffee shop manager George Hoyt. We have been a community partner for a long time and part of the neighborhood for a long time. Anybody that comes in here, they realize right away we're in a unique environment and that we have a mission that's a little bigger than just serving coffee. By breaking down the barriers between the sighted and the blind, 33 and Elm creates an inclusive, welcoming environment while forging a stronger community. 33 and Elm is located on Westgate City Boulevard in Greensboro, and they have a website, 33 AND Elm Coffee House. That's 33andelmcoffeehouse.com. Well, that sound means we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it, and you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974, and they can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available at our podcast as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. So long until next year.